listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void. Across the river, from the bench where I sat, stands a vague, blighted forest known as the Allen Woods. It is remarkable for not being remarkable, while yet bearing a name. There are so many nameless, beautiful woods in Lemon and elsewhere that one expects the nomination to connote the presence of a special feature. One would think the Allen Woods must be host to some exquisite bug, or superlative tree, or the proud owner of a glacial erratic. But no, it is a grim, ignominious woods, without path or variation. The sickly trees hang in loose grief everywhere, as though in endless attendance of their own mass funeral. The ground is trenched and foul-smelling, except for a very few old owls hooting in the distance. There's no wildlife, no squirrels or snakes or deer or crickets. As I sat on the bench, fencing with the boredom of the stalwart constraint that I do nothing until required, I considered such things, hoping to find in my mind a solution that could not be found in the world. I also searched the trees across the way for an imperceptible owl. Of all the creatures of the world, the owl is the least amenable to vision. As the secret code of birds, they guard the very edge of reality itself. And to see one is to know that one is oneself approaching the looking glass. I have seen more owls in my dreams than in the world. In my dreams, they are like shipwrecks, toppled upon the needling framework of a tree, or crashed upon the rocks of some imagined ocean. I never hear them in my dreams, but see them. I never see them in the world, but hear them. But I soon gave up and simply sat and listened to the drumming river, and the day passed as a photograph held before my eyes. A slow procession of similar moments, of moving along water and grief-struck trees. I stood a few times to stretch my legs. I looked here and there. I reread the wrinkled note and examined the cardboard box for secret instructions. One must be both firm and casual in one's interpretation of what is required. If one's legs are falling asleep, then one must stand. Do nothing, in this sense, is not a call for paralysis. Hunger itself may be the requirement that sets you on the move. As it grew darker, and the first feathers of sleep began to brush my back, it occurred to me that I should rather be on the lookout. But for what, I could not say. So I pushed free of the cloister of daydreams, and brought myself coldly forward into concentration, so that I would not miss whatever I was meant to see or hear. It was likely that even Owen Martindale had no idea what might be next for me. It was the incongruous manner of the stalwarts to simply lay the groundwork, to point mystically into the distance, and then withdraw. The only clue they provided was that a clue would be forthcoming. So I grew deeply aware, which is the most exhausting of still business, and prepared for the arrival of my clue. A smoke signal, or perhaps an unexpected squirrel chittering over the snow-topped mud of the Allen Woods. Even a fussy little noise might draw me out, a scratch or distant hammer. As my eyes came into focus, I saw it, quiet as the pocket of a shadow on a low branch in the mean twilight directly across the water, the fallen coat figure of an owl. His back was to me, and he slumped over his wings in imitation of my seated form. I watched his head turn slowly as the moon, as he tracked something in the distance. I followed his gaze to the far bend of the river, where the cuff of ice died into the broken wrist of free black water. And then I saw it too, and we both sat watching in our lichened forms, as a white bureau of frosted ice came rafting down over the water. As it drew closer, its details began to shift. The severe glacial wedge grew fluffy, revealing touches of crimson and gold over its mounds of gathered cream and ornamental tassels. The owl and I stared together in disbelief and wonder at this exotic luxury of ice until, a moment later, as it crossed our finish line, I put a reluctant name to it. And even though I knew exactly what it was, this queenly steadfast thing floating by on a pair of pontoons, even so, I thought it best to think of it initially as a boat. But it was not a boat. It was a bed, a mattress on an iron frame, topped with coloured pictorial linens and airy pillows. I called all this out to the owl, reducing to a name what had been mystery, that we might both then permit it to slip away unnoticed. "That's just a bed, old owl, just a riverbed," I said. But as I turned for the bird's acknowledgement, I saw his shadow slip from the branch as he made his way directly to stand on the headboard of the bed, whereupon he stared at me with large eyes of infinite division. I was on my feet, splashing along into the frigid water, doing something, finally at last, because of all the silliest things in the land, winning this wild bed was, for me at least, required. Owl in the tree, a swattier lending to swattier plans, owl, take it from me. To sink in the forest, to sink in the sea, rise in the morning of discipline day. Holly bin bin, holly bin bin, holly bin bin day. As you walk down the streets, hear the citizen say, holly bin bin, holly bin bin, holly bin bin day. Owl in the tree, like a pretty old hat in the secretive leaves. Owl, I dreamt of thee, and I followed your call, but I found only trees. Rise in the morning of discipline day. Holly bin bin, holly bin bin, holly bin bin day. As you walk down the streets, hear the citizen say, holly bin bin, holly bin bin, holly bin bin day. I hastened after the bed, splashing along until the river deepened in a scornful fashion. I lifted my arms in the way of dainty children bracing against the frigid water. I didn't so much as dive into the river as timber down into it. My legs grew rock-like and stubborn, and then finally seized in the snare of the brutal waves. And with that, the rest of my body terminated all its former agreements with me. I gasped in the thick swirls and was sucked down into the engine of the current and churned for a time against a large, soft rock before I was once again expelled to the surface. And then we floated along in the turbulence, the bed and I, in a kind of Dali portrait of a man sleeping in his bedroom, where the room itself has exploded upon the wilderness and the principal objects of man and bed are depicted in their unrequited love, the privilege of sleep being recast as a foreshadowing of death. The moon hung, a small bit of chalk in the starry sky, as we zoomed along downstream. I had no control. I was neither swimming nor stroking the water at all, but the force of the river itself kept me tumbling up and bobbing along. We turned rapidly down the wet highway, and then soon the river slackened, grew into a wide dress, and softened, and we puffed out into a new, gloomy richness, and then came to a complete halt. It was here that I foresaw my end, for the drenched and rusty armor of my body could not continue to float without the motive upbringing of the river current itself. Clearly, in such a passionless spot, I should be sent straight away down to whatever Brookley equivalent of Davy Jones' locker. But yet, in the slow, wide sleep of the river, I did not sink, and my only guess was that the river had not only widened, but it had shallowed, too, that both the bed and I had run aground. My senseless donkey arms pushed against the river stones beneath me, and with the tiniest dribble of strength, I managed to climb up over my knees and hung there above the surface. And then, like a drowsy old murderer, I stood and stumbled toward the bed with large cardboard steps. I dawdled before it with a frost-burned mind. I wanted to leap upon it, climb instantly into its cotton guts for warmth. But even as I stood shivering, I knew there was a problem. How might I transition from one place to the next without converting each a little to the other? But at last, the hammering shake of my body got the best of me. I was very near to passing out and so decided, unanimously, that a damp bed was the best that a wet man standing before a dry bed could hope for. I simply fell forward onto its dry covers and lively springs and lay quietly for a moment in the welcome softness. A bluish dram of energy returned, and I spent it quickly. I sat bedside, removed my wet things, and draped them across the rail of the footboard, and then crawled hard for the covers. In the jounce of all this, I managed to dislodge the riverbed, and we once again began sailing downstream. I can think of little else to do upon the winning of such a wild bed. If it were a plane, I would fly it. If it were a car, I would drive it. If it was a sandwich falling from the sky and landing at my shoes, it would be my lunch. But the winning of a wild bed presents its champion with an offer of a very special kind. I imagine myself enjoying the most untroubled, the most lordly and tranquil sleep. The sleep of the dead, the sleep of emperors, the clean sleep of the free, the sleep of children, of babies. Warm as a fire under a pile of blankets, empty as the air itself, I went spinning along in slow, unfelt circles beneath the stars. Slipped up, drowned, woe begone, I died again today, oh. Go to bed, try to sleep, time to hit the hay, oh. Want too much, dream too much, always have to pay, oh. Rest my head, watch the stars, nothing left to say, oh. Once upon a time, a frog and princess met beside a stream in the magic forest. Princess tried to thank you. I lay awake, only to pin the moment to memory, to acknowledge the very fact of it, that I was lying on a bed on a river. Although it felt right, it felt required. I couldn't say exactly why, and it almost seemed more likely that I should stay on the bench and let the odd thing pass. But just as my eyes were about to paper shut, a long-buried memory flashed open, and I understood my compulsion. Stalwart's injunction notwithstanding, and despite the enticement of the owl, I would never have gone to all this trouble had I not had a corresponding experience when I was a boy of 7 or 8 years old that established the precedence. While I had very few hobbies as a boy, who was nearly constantly in their grip, one was reading. All the books I read at the time were of children who found unexpected portals to their beloved homelands in the most commonplace of items. Closets and thimbles, cupboards, rings and wardrobes. Another hobby was exploring, but this searching through the woods and over rivers and into any kind of secret thicket had a purpose. I was looking for my own way to cross over into the magical realms. When I was not reading about magical lands or searching for a doorway to them, I was doing something very plain and common. I liked to throw rocks. Thus it was, after a summer afternoon's adventure, that I found myself throwing rocks at a local river, trying to build up my skills as a stone skipper, as I hoped to achieve some kind of world record for skips. I gave a fairly wide berth to the fishermen dotting the water and banks into the distance, so that I not disturb them with my splashes. But as I tired of my record-seeking, I began to move along the sandy shores, getting closer and closer to the one fisherman I was on good terms with. Mr. Spencer Chatton was tall and tended to stand in the deepest water while he fished, almost swimming with the fish he sought, which I took as a kind of determination and cleverness. Although he never did, whenever we talked, it seemed that he was on the verge of teaching me the curious poetry and art of fishing. His instruction-like phrases began, "What you need to do, Sherwin," or "Before I even start to get into all that, Sherwin." Yet his conversation always veered off, and he never did teach me. But he had a kind word, and enjoyed my visits to his stretch of water, and always made the welcome suggestion that I take a close look at the catch in his bucket on the shore, at the long, blackish trout, like slippery excerpts of dark clay. But as I approached him that day, I heard him call into the air. "You see that right there, Sherwin?" he began, in what of course seemed an incipient fishing lesson. "Just lost my growler gramp on the riverbed," he said. I knew at once that by growler gramp, Mr. Chatton meant he'd lost one of his homemade flies, and I spun in anxious empathy to see if I could see this mysterious riverbed which had somehow stolen off with his tackle, but I saw no such mattress or bed floating away. Mr. Chatton removed his floppy hat, plucked a fresh fly from it, and began tying it to the naked line. I knew his flies by their generous flourishings, but not by name, and I asked which one the growler gramp was. "The green glass one," he said, biting the fly with his teeth, "with the mirror eyes and the long strands of silver flicker." Now, I thought to my 8-year-old self, well, I quite like Mr. Chatton. One day soon he'll teach me how to fish. He's very tall and stands in the deepest water and makes his own flies, which is the best way to do it. I tended to think of Mr. Chatton as the adult version of myself, and I often took the opportunity to admire him as a way of learning more rapidly how to be the person I would soon become. And so I thought to myself, how easy it would be for me to run back along to the bridge and intercept this riverbed. How easy to then swim out to it, and how fun, and how wonderful to snatch the growler gramp from the mattress or pillows or bed covers of this riverbed, and return it to Mr. Chatton, and perhaps my reward would be a lesson in fishing. I should note here that I was the sort of boy who kept excellent track of all that was nonsense, and no track at all of what was real. So his growler gramps and other silly homemade lures had more meaning and life to me than the name of my own street. And so I ran down the road as fast as I could and leapt directly off the bridge in my shorts into the deep water to wait. I swam and tread for a time, hoping I'd beaten the riverbed to this spot, as just ahead the white water began to boil. As there was no such thing as my riverbed, I was of course too late, and after 5 or 10 minutes I shunned my bad luck and swam for shore. Yet during that span of waiting for the bed to float into view, a deeper dream reworked my hero's mission. What began as the rescue of a growler gramp from a floating bed became the perfect fulfillment of my boyhood dream to return by way of magical chariot to my rightful birthplace in a dazzling kingdom. How this would come to pass seemed completely obvious to me. I would paddle out to the mattress and climb aboard the bed. I would begin the hard work of getting the hooks of the lure free of the ticking. I would have no thought other than this, but just as I got it free, I would look up, and too late, observe the awful rough waters of the falls. I would have to stay aboard the bed, tumble over the falls, and my adventure would thus begin. For that first day, I would live on the bed, the hazardous water all but preventing a swim to shore. But I'd pick snacks from drifting logs. I imagined sandwiches on strings dangling down from overhanging branches. But eventually, I would have to sleep. And here was the finale of the dream, the transition point, the doorway, home. For I felt it deep inside, as a warm string tugging between heart and soul, that if I fell asleep on the riverbed, that I would finally wake up in the magical world of my birth, a kingdom of witches and talking animals, my principal and primary residence. So it was that had I not long ago misunderstood Mr. Chatton and entangled my dream of going home upon a non-existent riverbed, I would not have been so possessed now. For how could I not, given the absurd opportunity, fulfill the brightest of my ancient dreams, to climb aboard a riverbed, fall fast asleep, and let it humbly spin me into the vortex of other realms, and finally, take me home.
On the winning of a wild bed, somewhere I can lay my head. I'm not sure just how I know I climb aboard and off we go. Long the riverside the boy would lie and dream his bed came gliding by. You float downstream to sleep alone, and waking up be welcome home. What of the world remains? The king with the golden chains fall down with the falling rain. Hear the owl call that I hear. Hear the owl call that name. On the winning of a wild bed, somewhere I can live. Not sure is how I know I climb aboard and off we go. I'll float downstream, I'll sleep alone. When I wake up, be welcome home. What of the world remains? The king with the golden chains. Fall down with the falling rain. Hear the owl.
I woke to a sound of dribbling drift, of air and space and water droplets, of distant winds, remembering where I was, on a bed on the river, and on behalf of my boyhood self, for the adventure and pleasure of wondering what sort of world I would find, I kept my eyes closed. It was the purest courtesy to the dreams of my 8-year-old self. As I listened for clues, I realized how rare it is, almost always never, that one falls asleep in one place and wakes in another, while remaining completely undisturbed in the same bed. When I finally opened my eyes, I saw blue sky, and then looking left, gazed over the water. An illusion went to work in this squinting sidelong glance, or perhaps from my morning mind. But as I looked, it seemed to me that the river bank was something in the very extreme distance. Miles away, it seemed, at the water's edge, a miniature forest stood, lost in the rising morning mists. I noticed then a discernible lack of motion. We were no longer spinning, no longer moving. As before, it seemed the bed and I had run aground. I sat up, blinked, rubbed my eyes, and looked about. My illusion was my reality. I was in the middle of a vast lake. Except for a rocky island, splayed with 6 or 7 trees, a few hundred yards away, there was only smooth water for a mile in all directions. And it wasn't even an island, I supposed, more so a jutting. I dropped my hand in the water and paddled to see the effect. The bed washed gently to a side. My frustration had no time to build as my eyes fell upon an oar lashed to the opposite side of the bedposts. I did not think of the good strange fortune of this tool of boating, but quickly untied it and began stroking at the water, paddling my bed toward the tiny island. In the surprising mystery of my new surroundings on the quiet lake, I had failed to immediately register yet another disturbance. For the bed, which had seemed fairly large to me the night before, revealed itself, in the morning, to be a child's bed. The coverings, which had seemed compatibly adult, were lacy and bright, with fairy-tale images of castles and princes and unicorns and dazzling sunsets. So I paddled toward the almost island. I watched it now and then as the oar stroked the water. The closer I got, the worse my plan seemed. There would be no obvious benefit to standing upon such a small stone. In addition, I was not yet dressed, and though my outfit was puffing dryly on the rail, the small bed did not seem stable enough for an old man's clumsy journey back into his clothes. Much better to get my things on while standing on the solid ground. A wiser choice would have been for me to row to shore. A longer paddle, but smarter. And yet, something inside me did not want perfect reason, something that defined the island as the best and only destination. I pictured myself dressing there happily, being completely upon it, as a man on a horse, on all its edges, without movement. Perhaps the ongoing assortment of unreasonable things had accreted to to the point where I was relying purely on intuition. The world, myself included, had failed to make sense for a long enough duration that the wielding of logic itself was illogical. My eyes went from the paddle moving through the water to the strange trees of the island. As I drew closer, I spied their special difference. A single issue each of a birch, an oak, an elm, a cherry, a spruce, and apple tree, each standing strong and in full cloak of leaf, despite the winter. The harder I paddled, the slower I moved, and to the degree that I arrived at the island, the bed disappeared beneath me. It was sinking in direct proportion to my arrival, so that, as I arrived at the postage stamp of earth at the center of the quiet lake, I had to step upward from the bed onto the rough rock of the shore, and it was only as an afterthought that I tried to reach for my dark costume, my Hunalikan, but too late, as the old bed, with its coverlet tapestry of fairies and castles and good knights, sunk into the water. I stood, unclothed, on the tiny island, and as wrong as it was in so many ways, I felt quite peacefully sure that everything was perfectly in order. I was meant to be here, quite in this way, exactly so, discharged of clothes, devoid of purpose. For the little warm string that raveled between my heart and soul was pulling gently in its pleasure, and both the old man I was and the boy I'd been stood together in graceful providence, home at last. Listening to atoms, motion, and the void.